Happy Sabbath. Thank you for this opportunity to come together and to commune and study. Today's date is January 25th, 2013. And our study today is entitled, Peace Comes After Wrath. In our last study, 2 weeks ago, we spent some time in Isaiah 66. And today we are going to delve even more deeply into it as we marry the themes of Isaiah 65 along with Isaiah 66. And as we join in that study, many of the myriad and other scriptures that we've become familiar with in times past. 2 weeks ago, we saw that our peace will not come until Jerusalem emerges. And we understood that Jerusalem represents the people, the leadership core whom the Lord is going to bring together to evangelize the world. That's going to be their work, their duty, and their responsibility. Some people refer to them in ignorance as the 144,000. We just merely consider them the leadership of the Lord's church. That includes the 144,000, but is not limited to that number. The 144,000 will be those of Jerusalem who are elected by heaven to have ministerial duties and responsibilities. Therefore, I'm glad to have an opportunity to reinforce that. But we saw that our peace comes with their emergence. Oftentimes, people will write to me and express to me the problems that they have. I'm associated with the mustard seed. Why am I still struggling? Why do I still have problems? Well, they need to understand that you are going to receive your peace. That's why it says, I'm reading 66, verse 10 of Isaiah, "Rejoice ye with Jerusalem, be glad with her, all ye that love her. Rejoice for joy with her, all ye that mourn for her." Verse 11, "That ye may suck and be satisfied with the breast of her consolation." That we saw in our prior study is a unique understanding, because we've always had the delight and the insight that we would be the instructors of Jerusalem. And this text does not teach otherwise. Our efforts and our energies are going to be, as prophecy has shown in the past, to enlighten Jerusalem. But the Lord has given a different understanding now of the breastfed milk as an instrument that brings delight and joy and comfort. Oftentimes the baby is agitated and crying and whatnot, and when the mother puts it on the breast, a peace and a calm comes. Your peace and your calm is going to come not by some outstanding recognition by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, not by being on somebody's talk show, being broadcast throughout the world, not by people acknowledging your wisdom. It's going to come by Jerusalem's emergence. When she emerges with joy and celebration, that's when you'll be glorified. That's when you'll be vindicated. And the Lord points you to that day for your joy. And when I say joy, that's just a synonym for peace. You're agitated now. Why do people think I'm so crazy? Why is it that what I teach is so countervailing to convention? Every time I turn around, now it seems like the mustard seed is teaching something more controversial. And it's a little destabilizing. You're agitated. But you can understand that the day of peace is going to come. And it's not going to come by convincing people in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I'm sorry to report that to Davidia. That's a major conflict with them. They've been oriented all these years to convincing them, thinking that the 144,000 are going to emerge from, and I use this word as quotes, you'll run across it again in the study, they think that the 144,000 are going to emerge from that troop. They're not. That is a false dream. Your peace comes with Jerusalem. But I must report to you a destabilizing theme that the mustard seed has not spent a lot of time emphasizing in its ministry. And that is that peace comes after the wrath. We're focused on the peace, and that's good, that's being positive. But there are some terrible events that are going to occur at the hand of the Lord. It's my duty and responsibility to introduce to you the name of the Lord. He's meek and lowly, but He is not predisposed to committing and executing judgment. This is what needs to be done to save the world. And I envision that Father is glad that He's got Christ to do this work. That's why John 5 says, the Father judges no man. He's committed all judgment unto the Son. We need to understand, as we refine the distinctions here, that Jesus is not going to execute the judgment in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But an executive judgment is at hand, and it cannot be ignored. The day of recompense draweth nigh, and it's the day when the Lord expresses His wrath and His anger. Well, I didn't know that Christ was like that. I thought that I could push Him to the brink and then some. The universe is going to find out differently. And His name is going to be vindicated in His wrath. Therefore, we can summarize the first portion of this study by telling you that first comes the glory. The day is going to come when the mustard seed is going to be glorified. That means the world is going to recognize that we've been right. The church is going to recognize that we've been right. The highest officials in the church. Davidia is going to recognize at the loud cry, behold the bridegroom coming, at the lightning flash. The foolish virgins are going to understand that the mustard seed advent was right. That's our glory. Then comes the work. That's where we go forward and take our ministry to the Sunday-keeping churches, to Jerusalem, the sons and daughters of America's former slaves. And we spend, as much work has been dedicated to show, 3.5 years by evangelizing them in power, a period that parallels the Pentecostal period. Remember how the disciples were glorified at Pentecost? Everybody saw the marvels of their inspiration. None could deny it. And they were able to convert their brethren. Not the Gentiles. Their brethren had come from different nations who assembled themselves in Jerusalem. They were able to convert them. They became Christians. We see the glory. Then we see the work. Then comes the rest. The R-E-S-T. That comes after that 3.5 year period of time. You should know, therefore, that if you're not busy in the work now, I know some of you are thinking, I'm tired already. See, you really haven't been engaged in the work in its fullness as disciples. I remember the 11, they sat at the feet of the Lord for 3.5 years and learned the intricacies of His gospel and His truth. They didn't think that they had the ability to advance on their own. They didn't understand the power of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit gripped them, and they ran with the gospel in power. That's why when the Lord announced that He was going to leave, they became saddened. And the Lord says, I'll send you another comforter. If I don't go, the comforter can't come. You remember those references, don't you? And they went forward. That's a type of the work that you as mustard seed Adventists are going to perform. You can look forward to that. But let me tell you, it's work. If you got a period of relaxation now, enjoy it. There's going to be a time when you're going to have to pick up the sieve and begin to harvest by the power of the Holy Spirit backing you. But after that period of 3.5 years, you will have trained the 144,000. And they will benefit by the outpouring of the Spirit. And that's when you enter into your rest. You need to understand the rest for you to understand the peace. It's nice, isn't it, on a hot summer day, you can sit on your front porch, sipping on a cool glass of lemonade, and watching the gardener do the work. That's rest. That's not work. Your work will lead to your rest. But we need to speak a little bit more about that. I'm looking forward to doing so as we advance. Let me read, though, before, as a prelude, Isaiah 66, verse 15. For behold, the Lord will come with fire. Talking about the coming of the Lord. This is not the Lord of hosts. This is not the second coming of Jesus, as Adventists have taught all these years. This is talking about the invisible return of Christ. We have never understood it before in the history of the world. It's a point that deserves accentuation. This is the day when Christ returns. You're familiar with the promise of His return. I believe it is in Luke 16. And we're going to quote it later on in exactitude. Where the cry is made at midnight, behold, the bridegroom cometh. That's another prophecy pertaining to the return of Christ. But in that prophecy, He hasn't come yet. You're just given the midnight cry that He comes. He's going to come. But this is a prophecy of the events that occur when He indeed does come. For behold, the Lord will come with fire, and with His chariots like a whirlwind. Why? To render His anger with fury, and His rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by His sword will the Lord plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. It's not a peaceful message, but it's one that we need to declare and to teach and to understand. The Lord is going to return, and He's going to destroy, as we saw last week, the wicked in His church. But let me focus in on verse 15, because it says He's going to return for one reason, to render His anger with fury. Question that we need to ask and to answer is, why is the Lord so angry? Because really, people don't understand. If you don't understand the righteousness of Christ, you need a careful teacher to delve into this subject. It's called His strange work. The day when He executes His church. For you to understand this and to teach it, you have to understand the righteousness of Christ. And if it causes you inhibitions, then it's my job to allay those inhibitions. And the way that I begin to do so is by posing to you the question and then giving to you the answer. The question is, why is the Lord so angry? Now, in our last study, we determined the people to whom he's angry with. We spent a great deal of effort to show that he's angry with the people in his church, the Seventh-day Adventist church. We've seen this happen before. It should not be a surprise to us. He took his people, Israel, and for 3,000 years took them through the fire because he was angry with them. Nobody likes to talk about that because they really don't understand why he's angry. Anybody who's ever been married can know that sometimes you can do things to make people annoyed with you. Am I the only one, or can you relate to that? Sometimes you can do things and you could make people annoyed, and they're walking around in a huff, and they're walking around with a scowl on their face, and you just can't understand why. If that can happen with us, then that can happen with the Lord. But the Lord has got an emissary, an agent now, to explain why he's so angry. First of all, the Lord loves the Father. He interrupted his schedule to come down, not because he wanted to, the Word shows in John chapter 8, but because the Father sent him to deliver a message to his church so that they could receive everlasting life. And these people have completely ignored the Word of the Highest. That makes the Lord upset. You may not be upset with it because you don't have his respect for the Highest. But he taught you to pray, "Father, not my will, but thy will be done." That's the respect that the Lord has for the Father. Yet, all these years, under Jesus' administration, his church, the people that were elected to represent heaven on the earth, the people who boasted their Laodicea, the last church, the church declaring judgment, the Seventh-day Adventist church, had become experts preaching Christ, extolling the virtues of the Bible, claiming that they were elevated above everybody else, and I'm here to tell you that they were. Yet, when the truth of the Word came to them, they despised it because the purveyors upstaged them. And they turned their back on the Word. That's why the Lord is wrathful. One of the reasons. You know, I remember an incident where two cousins, age 14, same age, measuring themselves. One was 5'2", and the other was 5'8". And it looked to everybody that witnessed it that the one who was 5'8" was the tallest, the one who had the most physical stature. And that was the case at age 14. But then when age 18 came, the one who was 5'8" stopped growing, and the one who was 5'2" grew to be taller. That's the way the church has advanced. In the Christian discourse, the Seventh-day Adventist church was established on the principle of the spirit of prophecy. None of the other churches were governed by a prophet. None of them were visited by God in that way of glory. They stood taller than everybody else. But because they stopped growing, now Jerusalem has passed them by. They become people of a taller character. Yesterday we recriminated and condemned them because they rejected the Word. But now they've got more respect for the Word than the Seventh-day Adventist church. It's enough to make the Lord mad. I'll give you another example. I remember a secular example. If any of you know about basketball, remember David Robinson? playing for the Navy at 6'2". The reason why he didn't get recruited by the major colleges, because there's almost everybody is at least 6'2". They didn't anticipate his skill. But by the time he became a junior, he was 6'11". That means his skills on the court were as grandiose as a person of smaller stature, yet he had more height. Therefore, by the end of his career, he was celebrated by the basketball sports world, drafted as a pro, and became a preeminent player. Just because you're tall today doesn't mean you're going to remain that way. I got a lot of examples. A couple years back, Vinette and I were just really glorying in the computer system that the Lord had given us. It was fast, it was powerful, it had good memory. Then all of a sudden it crashed. And we were menaced by that. But now, as a result of that, we upgraded and we have a more powerful system, more accommodative to the computer world, more technologically advanced, superior than what we had before. We didn't want to on our own upgrade, therefore the Lord crashed us and upgraded for us. The church has to continuously grow and upgrade. And when they don't, they become hypocrites. That's why the Lord is upset. Seventh-day Adventist Church claims to embrace the spirit of prophecy. And Davidians go further than that. Not only do they laud E.G. White, but they laud V.T. Hotev. Yet both of those prophetic writers of inspiration told them that their faith is going to be predicated upon their fidelity to the Word. Somehow or another, they quote these grand authors and they miss this outstanding and major theme. And they want you to believe that they hold on to and embrace the spirit of prophecy. They do not. They've completely dashed the themes, the dominant theme of that work. They've become hypocritical. Another thing that makes the Lord upset, and the mustard seed has contributed to this greatly so that you can understand, they forgot Jerusalem. He refers to Jerusalem and to Zion as his holy mountain. Not only does that refer to the land, but in greater precision refers to the people as they abide in the land. They are to be elevated above all of the hills. That means that they are to be the highest source of godliness on the earth. Yet Davidia wants to point them to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Let's read a little bit of that by turning to Isaiah 65, verse 11 and 12. But ye are they that forsake the Lord, that forgot my holy mountain, that prepare a table for that troop, and have furnished the drink offering unto that number. Let me interrupt myself here with a parenthetical insertion. Isaiah 65 seems to be a recrimination against Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. And Isaiah 66 seems to be a recrimination against the entire church, Davidia as well as nominal Adventists. It's saying that Davidia forgot his holy mountain. You could not apply that to the Seventh-day Adventist Church because they never taught about a special people that are going to return to the land of Palestine. Davidia has taught that. And over the course of 80 years now, they've ignored the truth that Jerusalem, the sons and daughters of America's former slaves, are going to emerge and are going to be his stellar light to the world. They've ignored that. Therefore, they've ignored the people that are going to inhabit the land in leadership. That's what a mountain refers, elevated above the other. Not just theologically, but politically, spiritually, morally. What did they do? They prepared a table for that troop. They prepared a table for another group of people. They sought to transform the people in the Seventh-day Adventist Church into the ones whom the Lord favored and whom He wanted them to devote their energies and efforts toward. He therefore introduces us to the reason why He's angry. He says, because you've forgotten Jerusalem and you've elevated this other group, the same brethren that Isaiah 66 says, cast them out and said, let the Lord be glorified, He prepared a table for that troop. Therefore will I number you to the sword, and ye shall all bow down to the slaughter. Why? Somebody asked, why the Lord so angry? He's going to tell you why. This is why. Because when I called, ye did not answer. When I spake, ye did not hear, but did evil before mine eyes, and did choose that wherein I delighted not. They made a choice to ignore the Lord, to turn their backs upon His word. That's why He says, when I spake, ye did not hear. That reminds us of what we've learned in John 6, where the Lord told the people, symbolizing the Christian world, that to receive life everlasting, that they have to receive it from the Son of Man whom the Father has sealed. He says, and I will raise Him up in the last day. Why? To re-declare the testimony of Jesus. That's when He spake. Traversing in greater clarity to John 13, not losing your place in Isaiah 65, verse 20 of John 13, verily, verily, I say unto you, he that receiveth whomsoever I send, receiveth me. And he that receiveth me, receiveth him that sent me. Therefore, if you turn your back upon the one whom the Lord sent, you have no emissary. You have no advocate. You turn your back on Christ and the one who sent Christ, the Father. This is why the Lord is upset. Isaiah 65, reiterating verse 12, a portion of it. Because when I called, ye did not answer. When I spake, ye did not hear. But did evil before mine eyes, and did choose that wherein I delighted not. Well, how in the world were we going to know what delighted the Lord? You have an opportunity to learn of Him. His delight is in doing the will of the Father. His delight is trumpeting His will and testament. They rejected that. We need more elaboration on that? Isaiah 66, verse 4. Reiteration. I will choose their delusions, and I will bring their fears upon them. Because when I called, none did answer. When I spake, they did not hear, but they did evil before mine eyes, and chose that in which I delighted not. But it gets worse than that. We can elaborate even further to answer our question, why is the Lord so upset? By turning to Luke chapter 11. Just reading here a little, there a little. Let's read verse 44. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, the scribes and Pharisees, the people to whom the church looks to be their teachers. A woe is pronounced against them. For ye are as graves which appear not, and the men that walk over them are not aware of them. In other words, people don't see their death sentence. They are as graves. People see them as eternal light dispensers. They don't recognize that these people are teaching doctrines that can only lead to death. Therefore, the people who assemble themselves under their leadership, who are dependent upon them to carry their wagon, so to speak, are people that are misled, and the Lord pronounces a woe to them. We could go to Ezekiel 33 to explain the woe a little more. The woe basically means that if the people set up a watchman, then if the watchman fails to trumpet the warning, the people are not going to be preserved. They're still going to fall by the sword. And we're talking about the sword in our study today, so that's quite appropriate. But the Lord is going to hold them responsible for their death. Therefore, if you think that the slaughter that we're describing is reprehensible, and it is, by the time it's all over, it's not going to be chargeable to Christ. It's going to be chargeable in theological accounting by decree of the highest to the people who were set up as watchmen. They are going to be held responsible for the deaths. It's just Christ that executes them. And really, there's no reason for sadness, because these are people, when you tell them that Christ offers life without death, they recoil against that and recriminate against it. That's heresy. They reject it. Resultingly, they are calling for their own death, even though they claim to be connected with the Lord. But that's Luke chapter 11, verse 44. Now let us skip down to verse 52. Woe unto you lawyers, for ye have taken away the key of knowledge. Ye enter not in yourself, and they that were entering in ye hindered. They took away the key of knowledge. That means that they refused to learn to choose the good and refuse the evil. They refused to embrace the testimony of Jesus. But if that were not bad enough, illustrate. I know some people that are afraid to fly. They just don't fly. They don't make it their purpose to stop others from flying. But the Lord pronounces a woe on these Pharisees, these hypocrites, who profess to know the law. He calls them lawyers. Not only do they take away the key of life, but those who show an interest, they prevent, they hinder, they implore them not to listen. That really is the summation of their evil. And this is what makes the Lord so angry. If you don't genuinely believe, let somebody else make the decision on their own. Now, anybody who trusts you and ignores the word is going to fall by the sword, provided they abide in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But the Lord has stated already is going to hold you responsible for their death. They show an abhorrence to Christ. But worse than that, they're reminiscent of Lucifer's efforts in heaven when he resisted Christ. But worse than that, they make their charge against the voice of the highest. The testimony of Jesus was dictated to him directly by Father, a thing which Lucifer never did. Lucifer rejected Christ's promotion and went to war against him. These Laodiceans, on their own energy and on their own effort, now are acting like the devil, trying to winnow away the Lord's kingdom, because their own proud necks are on the line. They're misery that loves company. And this is why they're deserving of the Lord's slaughtering weapons. They made it their purpose to steer the entire church away from Christ. You can't have peace and goodwill on earth so long as people such as that are in control of the word. Why is the Lord so angry? They are people of great ingratitude. Nothing turns them. No gratuity extended to them by heaven convinces them to turn to the Lord. They continue to attack His work. I haven't left Isaiah chapter 66, but I'm interested in referring you to Matthew chapter 7 to show you how you should respond to such people today. Matthew chapter 7, verse 6. A commandment is given. The Lord speaking, at the direct dictation of the highest, give not that which is holy unto the dogs. Neither cast ye your pearls before the swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn again and rend you. The Lord is comparing these hypocrites now to swine. And when you look into this, and you can appreciate now through your experiences what we're being told. To illustrate, I know a lot of people in my own family that are not vegetarians. They're Seventh-day Adventists. They don't accept vegetarianism. But if the mustard seed proclaims that the Bible does not promote vegetarianism, they take those pearls and they don't say, yes, I've been vindicated, amen. They trample them and they join the attack on you. Don't think that any of the graces that the mustard seed has unfolded is going to win them. To illustrate, the mustard seed proves from the Bible that what we refer to as lesbianism, female-on-female sexual expression, is not condemned by the law. You would think, therefore, that Adventist lesbians would rally around that, right? No, they'll take that, enjoy in that, trample it under their feet, and they'll continue in their charge to attack you. It's enough to make the Lord upset. That type of ingratitude. This is why the mustard seed is focusing on the fact that we ourselves should not purvey the same spirit. We ought to continuously celebrate our graces and express our appreciation to the Lord for them. But the people in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, those whom the Lord promises to visit in His wrath, they practice a different type of salvation. It's salvation by lottery, so to speak. Some of you all played the lottery. Let's not kid each other. I have. I'd love to put a dollar down on the table and have that turned into $10,000. But it's just a matter of probability. You got one out of a 10 million chance of that happening. That's not the way the church was designed to operate. A lot of people in my family, as well as your family, a lot of people that are closely connected to this work, they think that, what are the chances that the Lord could visit my family? Slim chances. Improbable. Therefore, I'm not going to trust my faith in His Bible light. They think that it's just, as I say, an improbability. What are the chances, I'll use my family, that the Lord could speak through a West? Or an Anderson, or a Moore, because Vinette's family is Adventist as well. Oh, the chances are slim to none. There's 7 billion people on the earth. It couldn't be possible that He could visit us. But the fallacy of that logic needs to be exposed. Because God visits His own. If you're a people that are connected with His work, then It's a matter of the highest probability that the Lord would visit you. And if you're not connected to His own, then why are you lauding the Seventh-day Adventist Church as the basis of your faith? You're proclaiming to the world that you belong to God's kingdom church. Hence, if He's got a message, then you're going to be the first one that He's going to visit. It's not a matter of probability. It's a matter of faith. Therefore, the wise are the ones that receive His peace. Let's revert back to Isaiah 65, read verses 13 through 15. You know, verse 12, he explains the reason why he's going to cut them down. We showed that this is a prophecy zeroing in on the Davidian dimension of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Those who receive the highest light, they will be the scribes and the Pharisees. Verse 13 says, therefore thus saith the Lord, behold, my servants shall eat, but ye shall be hungry. Behold, my servants shall drink, but ye shall be thirsty. Behold, my servants shall rejoice, but ye shall be ashamed. He's not just going to cut them down. He's going to let them see what they've missed out on. He's going to show them that they're not invited to the welcome table. You know how African Americans used to sing that song? I'm going to sit at the welcome table one of these days? Well, this is the welcome table. The welcome table is going to be established and they're going to be excluded. It doesn't stop there. It says, behold, my servants shall sing for joy of heart. I know you're howling right now, but the day is going to come when you're going to sing for joy of heart. But ye shall cry for sorrow of heart, and shall howl for vexation of spirit. And ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen. For the Lord God shall slay thee and call his servants by another name. These are the people that forgot his holy mountain. They taught his holy mountain in part. But when the Lord came to explain his holy mountain, they ignored it. These represent Davidian. Understand, we do not reject the work of E.G. White and V.T. Hata. We recognize them and laud them as being inspired of the Lord. But whenever you make a transition in light, you have to show the theological accounting trail. You have to account for the reasons why you're advancing beyond E.G. White and V.T. Hata. And the mustard seed Adventists have done that. The Davidians have not continued and have given no accounting for their rejection of this work. They left no accounting trail. Isaiah 65 expands upon it even further when you read verses 1 through 6. I am sought of them that ask not for me. I found of them that sought me not. I said, behold me, unto a nation that was not called by my name. He sought by a group of people that asked not for him. They didn't know the distinction between Jesus and Christ. But he's found of them that sought him not. There's nobody associated with this work that began their commission seeking after the dove that rested upon Jesus. None of them understood that that was Christ. They found him. I have spread out my hands all the day unto a rebellious people. He spread out his hands. Remember, and what is it, Isaiah 53? Shows you the arm of the Lord. His hands, Jesus represents his arm. Then his message reiterated by the mustard seed, referred to in John 6 as the Son of Man, referred to likewise in Ezekiel 33 the mustard seed is likewise, therefore, because it reiterates the testimony of Jesus, represents the arm of the Lord. This is his hands. I have spread out my hands all the day unto a rebellious people, which walketh in a way that was not good, after their own thoughts. A people that provoked me. The provoke who? Pay close and careful attention to the pronoun. Provokes Christ. Provoked me to anger continually to my face. Now how could they provoke him to anger to his face? Israel on Sinai could not take his presence. You can guarantee that today the church could not take his presence. Deuteronomy 18, Christ promised that he will speak to them by raising up a prophet like unto Moses. And therefore, when he sends that servant forward, he says, if you reject he who I send, you reject me. Therefore, they provoke him continuously to his face. That sacrifice in gardens and burn incense upon altars of bricks, which remain among the graves and lodge in the monuments. They refuse to take the gospel beyond the grave. They refuse to teach that Christ can give them life without death. And they lodge in the monuments. You've passed by graveyards. You've seen large monuments. Famous people buried in those things. And the theological equivalence of that is E.G. White and V.T. Hotten. They lodge among those pillars of the faith. People who were once great, but have not escaped the grave, which eat swine's flesh, being symbolic here. They consume food that cannot make them whole. It's unclean. And broth of abominable things is in their vessels, which say, stand by thyself, come not near me. That me refers to Christ. It's enough to make them mad. For I am holier than thou. They see themselves as holier than Christ. These are a smoke in my nose and a fire that burneth all the day. Clearly, therefore, his wrath is not against the world. His wrath is not against Christianity, not against Islam, not against Judaism. His wrath burns against the holier than thou people of the Seventh Day Adventist Church, the people to whom he spread out his hands all the day. If he had spread out his hands to those other groups and they rejected him, well, he wouldn't do so because they haven't been prepped by the monuments the way the Seventh Day Adventist Church has. He spread out his hands all the day and they rejected him before his face, claiming themselves to be holier than him. Verse 6 of Isaiah 65. Behold, it is written before me, I will not keep silent, but will recompense, even recompense unto their bosom. Now, I think we can get a clearer picture of why the Lord is so angry. We can understand a lot of times your deeds, if thoughtless, can make others angry with you, even though you may not be aware of it. But you have the benefit, Davidian Adventism has the benefit because the Lord is showing them their grievances, and they're still rejecting it. We've spent some time in prior studies. Can't take the time today to lodge ourselves too long therein. But we've shown the episodes that developed around the Lord feeding the 5,000. And really to understand the events that occurred there, you have to read it in Matthew chapter 14. More information is given in John chapter 6. And additional light is given in Mark chapter 6. Let's just read verse 51 and 52 of Mark chapter 6. Verse 51. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wondered. this is an account that the other gospel writers did not fill you in on. Oh, it tells you that he fed the 5,000. It tells you that he sent the disciples away on the ship. It tells you likewise that he ascended up to the mountain. We didn't read all those things. But now, it tells you that he walked towards them. They were frightened of him. And then it says something amazing. Because it says, and he went up unto them into the ship. Now, it was what? Matthew chapter 14, I believe, that showed that Peter stepped out of the ship and himself began to walk on water. He began to sink. When he took his eyes off the Lord lifted him up, and they both entered the ship together. But when the disciples saw this, it says, they were sore amazed in themselves, beyond measure, and wondered. What I like about this text, it shows you the wonderment and the amazement of the disciple, but then it explains to you why they wondered and were amazed. It doesn't make really a lot of sense to Mark why they should have wondered and should have been amazed. Therefore, he saw the need by the prompting of the Spirit to explain why. Verse 52, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wondered, for they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. It's good that you find the Lord's work amazing and beyond measure. But it doesn't help for you to express those emotions if you've ignored his miracles beforehand, for that only means that your heart is hard. It's impervious to his righteousness. The reason why it's important to elucidate this dimension of that episode in the Lord's work is because their amazement and wonderment only lasts for a short time. It was only a couple hours beforehand, maybe 12 hours beforehand, that they saw the miracle of the loaves and the fish. And now they had forgotten that, and therefore they expressed surprise. Oh, Christ, I didn't even know you could do that. That means tomorrow, their hard hearts would still be impervious to his righteousness. We've got to work that out of us. We've got to be people of reminiscence. We've got to remember how the Lord's grace has blessed us and answered our prayers. And this is what it means to have not a hardened heart, but a soft heart. And when you understand this, when your hearts are softened in that way, then you can enter into his rest. Let's read in Hebrews chapter 4. When I say enter into his rest, that's another way of saying you can be at peace. That's when your work will finish and you could sit back and manage. Because your work, therefore, will be a work of managing the gospel. You could watch the 144,000 going throughout the world and doing their work. Verses 1 through 11. Let us, therefore, fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them. But the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we which have believed do enter into rest. As he said, as I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his work. And in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest. Seeing therefore it remaineth that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached entered not in because of unbelief. Again he limiteth a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it is said, today, if ye will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. Your rest comes from the reminiscent spirit that's going to declare his voice, that's going to be sent again, that's going to represent his testimony. And if you hear that voice, harden not your hearts. And now we know what it means to harden not your hearts. Don't forget the graces that he's bestowed upon you. For if Jesus, verse 8, had given them rest, then would he not afterwards have spoken of another day? There remaineth, therefore, a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own work. As God did from his, you're going to have a Sabbath rest. The day is going to come when your work is going to be done. And that is the day of your peace. It's peace in the wrath of God. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. And Paul points us forward to the day of rest. And now, having seen that, we can revisit Isaiah chapter 66. We were told that when we see Jerusalem emerge, that's going to be the day of our joy. That's going to be the day when we're going to be comforted. It's going to be the day of our rest. Isaiah 66, verse 18. Speaking of his anger, speaking of his slaughter, it says, for I know their works and their thoughts. It shall come to pass that I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. I told you, he's not upset with the nations. This revisitation is not the second coming of Jesus, which we've only partially understood yesterday. When Jesus comes, we've understood that he slays the wicked and he takes the righteous back home. But not so. The Lord slays an isolated group of people, the people to whom he had beckoned his voice all the day. He spread forth both his hands all the day. The work of Jesus' ministry and the work of the mustard seed's ministry. And the people that have ignored that are the people to whom he's angry with. The Lord is not irrational in his anger. And this is what we need to proclaim and teach. That's why he says, I will gather all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations. Now, pay close and careful attention to the pronouns. This is a plea. From verse 5, it says, hear ye the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, said, let the Lord be glorified, but he shall appear to your joy, and they shall be ashamed. These are people that tremble at his word. These are people like Peter that stepped out of the ship of Zion. They are no longer in the Seventh-day Adventist church. They are cast out for David's name's sake, because they recognize themselves as Davidians. In the case of the mustard seed, Davidians indeed. The Lord said, hear ye the word of the Lord, He didn't say, I will send you. He said, it shall come to pass, in verse 18, I will gather all nations, verse 19, and I will set a sign among them and send those that escape of them unto the nations. You have to understand. He's introduced a third set of people, those whom we would refer to as the 144,000. The people who've been promoted to be his prophets, priests, and kings amongst Jerusalem, the sons of America's former slaves. He sends them to the nations. Well, how did they get into the church? Your work, you haven't entered into your rest yet. The day of your work is going to come where you're going to take it to the Sunday-keeping churches. And you're going to bring them into the Seventh-day Adventist church. That's how they're going to see you, as we described in Isaiah 65, joying while they're in misery. Because you have these two classes in the church. That happens before the slaughter takes place. Because the rebellious in the church, if they're slaughtered, they can't howl for sorrow of heart. When they see you in your joy and in your victory, your joy comes from Jerusalem's emergence. He's going to take a subset of the people whom you teach by the power of the Spirit in 3.5 years, and he's going to send them to the nations. That's the 144,000 that Revelation 7 and Revelation 14 describes. He says, I will set a sign among them. What's the sign? It's not the sign of Emmanuel. The sign of Emmanuel's for the house of David. This is the sign of Maher Shalah Hashbaz. The end sign. He sets a sign among them, and he sends those that escape unto the nations. The slaughter takes place. The only people that remain are the leaders who evangelized Jerusalem, the disciples, and the subset whom they garner in. They are commissioned. Your work is over. You're going to enter into his rest. That's why you have to pay close and careful attention to the pronouns. To Tarshish, who, and Lud. I'm reading the rest of verse 19. That draw the bow to Tubal and Jabon, to the isles afar off, that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory. And they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. Don't tell me that Christ is merciless. He removes the rebellious in the church in an act of mercy so that he could have a people that can go to the nations and manifest to them his glory and his fame. Verse 20. But notice, before we proceed to verse 20, that if they declare his glory among the Gentiles, they have to be Hebrews. And they shall bring all your brethren. There are Hebrews scattered in the nations as well. And the Lord is going to extrapolate from them people that are qualified to be priests. Therefore, when they go to Poland and they take people off, when they go to Nigeria and when they take people, when they go to Peru and to China, there are Levites there that are going to conduct the ministry for their own people. And that's why the Chinese and the Peruvians and the Nigerians can celebrate, because one of their own has been exalted in their house. And they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Lord out of all nations, upon horses and in chariots and in leaders and upon mules and upon swift beasts, to my holy mountain Jerusalem, saith the Lord, as the children of Israel bring an offering and a clean vessel into the house of the Lord. And I will also take of them for priests and for Levites, saith the Lord. For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. Your converts now are going to remain. Isaiah 59 will help us to understand that. It gives you an overview from a different perspective. Verses 19 through 21. So shall they fear the name of the Lord from the west, and His glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion. He comes to the Seventh Day Adventist Church. And unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, saith the Lord. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith the Lord. This is covenant with those who turn from transgression. That's you. Yesterday, we're finding out through the Spirit of Communion that you've had a lot of transgressions, didn't you? So don't be afraid to admit it now. Because your claim to fame is you've turned from transgression. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith the Lord. My Spirit that is upon thee. And my words, that's the testimony of Jesus, which I have put in thy mouth, shall not depart out of thy mouth. Mustard seed Adventist. Nor out of the mouth of thy seed, 144,000. Nor out of the mouth of thy seed's seed, great multitude. Saith the Lord, from henceforth and forever. Therefore, it's describing the people of eternal salvation. They will always have the Father's words in their heart and in their mouth. It shall not depart forever. Tell me there's not a promise of life everlasting. Back to Isaiah 66, we were at verse 22. For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. Therefore, this shows you the distinction between those whom He sends and you. Hear ye the word of the Lord, it says. It's referring to the people that tremble at His word. He says, making the distinction in the pronouns, so shall your seed and your name remain. Great that your work is going to be over with Jerusalem. You're going to have rest. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord. And they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me. For their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched, and they shall be an abhorring unto all flesh. That means that those people that are destroyed, that destructive agent will never be reversed so that they'll live again. This gives you an overview of the entire three angels' message. It shows you the message from when it was presented by E.G. White to the time of the new earth, when we will abide before the Lord forever. We've seen now the day of our rest. There is a rest that remaineth, Paul says. And if you hear His voice and harden not your heart, you'll enter into that rest. It's going to be a glorious rest. It's going to be a day of eternal joy and peace. And with that, I bring the study to a close.